Good morning, everybody. It is February 24th, 2026, and in a rare display of effective introspection, Doug Ford had this to say about himself.
It's very challenging right now. I just sit back some days, and I'm not the only one. Everyone in the world sits back, and how can one person, one man, create so much turmoil around the world? Not just here in Canada, around the world. It's pretty staggering.
You're not wrong, Doug. You're not wrong. For the first time ever, get ready for a painful 2026. Ontario, Canada's biggest province, is poised for more layoffs, plant closures, and economic strain. Fantastic news. Slowdown in real estate market could put 100,000 jobs at risk in Ontario. Stuff is just going great in Ontario. Here is the Ontario debt clock, $460 billion. When Doug Ford came into office, it was just north of $300 billion. His track record so far is far worse than the Liberals when they were in office, and this is set to increase monumentally as we go forward in time. Yes, what else has Doug Ford been up to? Well, we've all seen this, but let's watch it again. Diageo, a company that's not even based in the United States.
About Crown Oil, that's what they could do.
Fuck you and your contribution to GDP, Diageo. Get out! Who needs real GDP growth when you can just go up the road to Ottawa to your buddy Mark Carney and ask him to ask the Central Bank of Canada to just print a bunch of money so that you can keep debt spending? Isn't that fantastic? But what is this? What is this black box doing? I don't understand. Let me get rid of this black box. Maybe it's, oh, so there's actually a caption. Doug Ford attacks Trump after Supreme Court blocks tariffs. I must now formally apologize for my mistake. Fat Trudeau, the stay-puffed marshmallow man himself that runs Ontario, his track record remains unblemished. He has no capacity for introspection. He just lies as easily as the rest of us breathes. He spins as easily as a top. He's in good company with his buddy, Mark Carney. Have you heard about the Alto high-speed rail project? The federal government, the provincial government, has been talking about this and how absolutely outstanding and fantastic it's going to be. 50,000 jobs, $38 billion to GDP, all kinds of low-cost estimates. But what you might not have heard of is the special expropriation rules for this project that are eroding long-standing property protections, due process, warns the Montreal Economic Institute. Now, I want to focus first on those two words, property protections, because you don't have property rights in Canada. You just have a piece of legislation that dictates how the process should unfold when the government comes along and says, it's taking your land. You have no recourse because your charter does not have any property rights in it, but you do have a piece of legislation that you could lean on for an expectation as to how that process is going to go. Except that under the budget that passed the House of Commons, they created the special rules, which had major amendments to the Expropriation Act. The High-Speed Rail Network Act, buried in the federal budget omnibus bill, grants sweeping new expropriation powers for the planned high-speed rail line between Toronto and Quebec City. The act creates a new Crown Corporation via HFR, just what we need, a subsidiary of Via Rail to oversee and carry out the project. Major amendments to the Expropriation Act. And again, it's an act. You don't have rights. It's just an act, which is why they can amend it. It should infuriate you. Your fake civil liberties in this country, your Charter of Rights and Freedom, which is supposed to be the highest law on the land, can be suspended by the government whenever they want. And even if they're found to have wrongly done so by the courts, there is no legal recourse for you who have been damaged. They're still trying to put people who had the law used on them during the Freedom Convoy, they're still trying to put those people in jail, even though the law was enacted illegally. Figure that out. But you don't even have fake property rights, and that's what this problem is, are being introduced in order to fast-track the project, notably by allowing VIA to override long-standing expropriation steps. Expropriation, the taking of private property for public use, normally requires the government to first make a good faith purchase offer and attempt to negotiate. This protects, quote-unquote, landowners from unnecessary takings and ensures fair compensation. Doesn't ensure anything. There's a negotiation. The government will still shove it down your throat at whatever price they deem. This just makes it easier for them to do so. The new law explicitly removes this requirement, eliminating the obligation to attempt to negotiate a common accord between the landowner and the government. That's right. You've got private property. It's been in your family for five generations. The government's going to come along and seize it from you. They're going to give you a timeline for you to get off it. They're going to take it at whatever price they deem worthy, whatever they want. Just like with this so-called gun buyback, they release a whole price list, and some of the prices are so ridiculously under market value, they're just shoving it down your throat because guns, the land under your feet, doesn't matter what it is, plastic straws, you have no right to private property. The government can literally take it all. So this new law explicitly removes the requirement. If VIA decides it needs a property for this project, it can get the Minister of Transport, Steve McKinnon, to directly issue a notice of expropriation. It does not need to send an offer, or negotiate, or demonstrate that a purchase attempt was made. Other changes, because there's more. Wait, there's more. Isn't Canada just wonderful? Other changes include eliminating the possibility of a public hearing. You're not going to get to talk about it. You're not going to have any feedback. Under the previous law, once an objection was received, the minister could call a public hearing in order to consult with the wider community about the impacts of the proposed expropriation. This form of consultation is entirely done away with. So your land's going to get taken from you. I can't call it stolen because you have no property rights. It's basically theft, but we'll say taken. It's going to be taken from you at whatever price they deem. Could be zero. They have the right under the law to just steal it outright. There will be no public hearings. Nobody's going to get to talk about whether or not they want this done to them or the community is served by having this done to them. The landowner's recourse is narrow. They have 30 days to submit an objection upon receiving notice of expropriation. Previously, the minister had 120 days to respond. The government has now stretched that window to 2 years. For properties targeted by VIA's project, VIA will be able to take your land, freeze your property, and cancel your sale agreements, all without negotiation, says Gigur. This government seems to have forgotten the lessons learned from the expropriation of farmlands for the Mirabel Airport project in the 1960s. Seems to me they haven't forgotten anything. They like being a bunch of thieves. That's what Ottawa does. They have guns, the guns of the state, and they help themselves to the money in your pocket. And if you don't give them the money in your pocket, they will destroy your life. And it extends to the land under your feet and your personal property. If they demand it, you just have to cough it up. Now, here's the kicker. The people who are subject to this, and there will be a lot. There will be a lot of land stolen in the name of this high-speed rail green climate change project because the mainstream media, CBC Marketplace, nobody gives a damn about the Canadians that are being robbed by this. All they care about is promoting that climate propaganda. The kicker is, if they identify your property as property that they want to take in the future, they don't even have to take it right away. They can just identify interest in it. You are banned from making improvements. You're banned from farming on it. You can't build structures. You can't make it commercially viable. So say you have a business. Say you got a business already operating on the property. You have to shut it down because you're not allowed to expand or build infrastructure or do anything with it, but you are responsible for maintenance. So while the land is being held in escrow, I guess, on behalf of the government, you get to pay the land taxes, you get to pay for any repairs, you get the maintenance upkeep, and they just put a post-it note on the fact that they're going to take it from you at whatever price with no recourse. And there is some rumor, so far unsubstantiated, that they can take your land and give you as little as 30 days or 90 days to get off it. Now, the truth is, no one knows how long you're going to have. The government will decide. The government will decide because of the expanded powers given to it through these modifications to the Expropriation Act. This sucks, and nobody's talking about it. But back to Fat Trudeau for a second, because we're not done. The country that we are emulating, the country that we most seem to want to become, indeed, the country that houses and... But back to Fat Trudeau for a second. I want you to note the background. There's two flags back there. There's our rag, and then there's this other rag, this thing where our king lives. The actual head of our state lives on this island. And this is an island, by the way, that has a government right now, which is on the verge of falling apart, should have fallen apart. I mean, some people have been arrested. Andrew's been arrested. I believe Mendelsohn was arrested as well, picked up on charges, as they should be, but the whole thing needs to go. Keir Starmer's named in the Epstein documents as well. This is a government that seems to be infected by people who are more than happy to procure the services of minors. I have to say these things because I don't want to be algorithmically censored through the company that Jeffrey Epstein was running. And these are the kinds of things, in addition to that very real reality, these are the kinds of things that are going on in Britain. Take a look. Just for the record, that was hot coffee, and you're going to see how quickly this man comes upon the police, who have already taken notice of his presence.
What's that about? Wait, what notes are you taking down?
I'm just writing stuff down.
Well, the fact that we're not doing anything.
Well, you're not
aggravating anyone.
Verbally.
I'm not doing anything.
I didn't mean to waste all your time. We didn't think it would be this bad. The Arsenal one was way better, honestly.
I didn't do nothing.
I was at the last Arsenal-Chelsea one.
Yidami.
You're a Chelsea fan.
Wait, no, Yidami's their team.
Can you nick him, man? He's used the word Yidami, which is legal, so let's nick him for public order. Let's get him out.
What? I thought that was a...
Just so we are absolutely clear, Yidami is a self-adopted nickname and chant used by Tottenham Hotspur supporters, including both Jewish and non-Jewish fans.
Now, shout out to Asmongold. This is a Warcraft video game streamer who has pivoted of late to social commentary. Not of late, he's been there for a few years. But he's delivering news to his community that they would otherwise not get. And credit where credit is due. And Yid Army isn't any type of hate speech, as you just heard. It's a recognition that this team has a lot of Jewish fans. I don't know if you know this, but Jews tend to like sports. Some Jews that aren't even politically involved, maybe don't even know where Israel is on a map, might be hard to believe, just like to cheer for sport and are quite proud of that and have created a chant that takes in both the Jewish supporters and the non-Jewish supporters, Yid Army. Now, this person just had coffee thrown in his face, but he's getting arrested for words. This is Britain, where 500,000 people have been debanked in 2025 alone for words. People are in jail for memes. This guy's getting arrested. There's something like, what, 6-8 cops that are arresting him? Who are these people? Like, what is it with police officers that don't have anything better to do? You still have the RAPE gangs going on in Britain. You have a government that is filled with people who willfully partook of Jeffrey's business model, but they're busy out there arresting people for saying a couple words that aren't even remotely ist in any way, just celebrating soccer. The guy is under arrest for using a slogan that celebrates a Jewish fan base. Can you believe that? And there's Dougie in front of the British flag. And he wants us to forget as well, King Dougie the Great. He wants us to forget that he was a proud supporter of Donald Trump on the way up. Back when he was running for election, back when he was virtue signaling the strongest, he had no problem with the United States. He's made a lot of money down there. There's a rumor out there, which he hasn't denied, that he's actually a dual citizen. This is before he threatened a crime against humanity, cutting off the Americans from electricity, all over a trade dispute. You have to understand, and I know I repeat it on this channel, our reaction to this trade renegotiation and tariff spat is completely over the top and irrational. All of the elbows up nonsense, which is leading to the destruction of this country. We are going to be in such weak shape. Whether you love Trump, whether you love America or not, you need to recognize that the Canadian people need that country more than we need any other country on earth. We need that business relationship. We have what each other needs, and we work better and we get richer when we work together. Our people, the Carneys, the Doug Fords, the Stephen Harpers, the people who have robbed you for decades, the people who robbed you of your civil liberties, the people who are stealing the property and land right out from under you in the name of their so-called climate change green high-speed rail project, which you may support, you may not support, I don't even care. It's the theft that I want to highlight. It's your lack of property rights. These people who have sold this nation down the river, the Stephen Harper, that was all on board with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Stephen Harper that brought the Foreign Investment Protection Act, which basically gave China carte blanche in this country, the Mark Carney who wants to sell us out to China, the very government that for the last 12 years was happy to train Chinese troops on our soil in Arctic warfare, allow them to operate police stations, allow them to launder money at such scale that you can measure it in double-digit percentages of our GDP, all benefiting triads who funnel that money back to Beijing. This government who sold out our sovereignty, who deindustrialized the country, took our manufacturing base and outsourced it and turned us into a resource colony. They want to now tell you that your pensions are going to be destroyed. They've said it. Because what does it mean when they say you're going to belt tighten, your standard of living is going to go down, and your purchasing power is going to decline? They've said all these things. That means that your fixed incomes are going to buy less and less and less, and you're going to hurt more and more and more. And they're telling you you have to do it to save the country after they've destroyed the place. And for the next segment, we have to revisit the theme of yesterday's video. And I know that's a bit of a hard pivot, but that's what we're going to do. Let's listen to Donald Trump when he was running for president.
As importantly, bringing back impoundment will give us a crucial tool with which to obliterate the deep state, drain the swamp, and starve the warmongers, these people that want wars all over the place, killing, killing, killing. They love killing. And the globalists out of our government. We're going to get the warmongers and the globalists out of our government.
I have to revisit some themes from yesterday's video. And I want to remind people, this is what Donald Trump said. And right now, there is a massive collection of U.S. force that looks like it's about to trigger a big war with Iran that has no clear strategic objective. Now, listen, hear me out. Because I talked yesterday, people want to parse and they want to nitpick. When I talk about Mossadegh and how the United States overthrew Mossadegh, who was the duly elected leader of Iran, and there's people who actually know their history, and they're just like, well, he wasn't elected. Parliament was elected, and he was appointed, and it had to be approved by the king, and he wanted to basically take that power and give it back to the people, and he wanted to liberate the oil underneath the Iranian government's feet, and instead of shipping the profits out to the crown, out to the city of London, he wanted to give those profits back to his people, and he just had to go, but he wasn't elected. If our prime ministers in this country are legitimate, then Mossadegh was legitimate. And the other thing, these so-called student protests in Iran, some of it is genuine. Yes, the energy is genuine. But you don't think the CIA's got money all over that? Do you not think the CIA went into Venezuela and paid off a bunch of people on the ground to make sure that that operation went flawlessly? People are comparing what happened in Venezuela and saying that the same thing can happen in Iran, and they're completely wrong. And they need to remember the lessons of Afghanistan and Iraq. I'm not anti-American. That should be obvious from my work. I am very pro-American, and I'm very concerned that this is the big trap. Whether you like it or not, the Republicans are soft heading into the midterms, and if things don't straighten out, if the wheels come off the economy, if a long protracted war where there's a lot of damage done to U.S. or Israeli forces in the region, that could be the nail in the coffin. I'm telling you, if you lose this movement, remember, go back and watch Trump's words. Those words were really important. A lot of the things that he said over the years are really important, highlighting that the people who are responsible for 9/11 didn't come from Iraq. They came from Saudi Arabia, getting booed for that. The balls on the man. Knocking Jeb Bush off the stage and dethroning the Bush dynasty. These were really important things. And anybody with two brain cells to scratch together that isn't blinded by the orange man bad propaganda would realize these are really good things. Now, that being said, this is a dangerous moment. Trump hits out at reports that top general flagged risks of attacking Iran. U.S. President slams reports that General Dan Kane warned him of risks of war with Iran as 100% incorrect. It wasn't incorrect. It's on the record back in January that it happened. And maybe it hasn't happened in recent times, and so that's how Trump doesn't lie on this file. But I want to make it understood. The Americans, I've said on this channel how they're locked in a battle to redefine the European relationship with the United States and redefine the relationship that the United States has with the city of London. The Don Roe Doctrine, This idea of reorganizing the Western Hemisphere, North America, and South America, and building this fortress that will trade with the world, will respect multipolarity, and will avoid nuclear Armageddon for who knows how many decades. It's actually a really good idea. And at the same time, as this battle's going on, it more or less eliminates the idea of parachuting the Shah or the children of the Shah, the restoration of the Shah. The Americans don't want that because that is what the British want. That's what the Europeans want. And that's why Trump has dismissed it, because he's fighting all of these different battles on all of these different fronts. And he owes a lot of his campaign, and he's given prestige, and he has elevated Israel and their foreign policy objectives to being right alongside the United States. And you can say that he's playing this long game, but I mean, the placement of Ambassador Huckabee in Israel, putting on the record, in his official capacity, putting on record that it would be fine for Israel to take the entire region, that's a significant thing, and it indicates some of the thought that is going through the administration. Here's the real problem. When the United States begins the air war with Israel, and they throw everything they've got at Iran, they can only maintain that pace, an all-out assault, for about a week. And then they have to go to targeting. And the reason for that is they can fly somewhere between 400 and 800 sorties a day. So they can do 600 sorties a day, but they can only sustain that for so long. You have pilot fatigue, you have mechanical breakdown, and you have the real threat, which is munitions. These high-tech munitions, inventories are thin because of the 12-day war, because a lot of those inventories have been sent to Ukraine. Stocks are thin and they've been depleted. So there's only so long this campaign can go on before it has to be paced. Now, in the 12-day war, which, I mean, is it really a 12-day war standing by itself, or is it just, did this start a long time ago and it's all one battle? When we look back historically in 50 or 100 years, provided we're able to look back, we're not clubbing each other over seeds and food, are we going to look at it as one big war and how it opened up? I think maybe we will. But during the 12-day war, people made the argument that Iranian tech was really old. They were sending, jokes were online about sending diesel-powered drones into Israel and all the slow-moving stuff, because that's how they opened. And the thing is Iran was playing it smart. They sent their old tech in. It got the very expensive anti-missile Iron Dome defenses firing off all of their ordnance. And then as it progressed and as it got further into the 12-day war, at the end, some of the more advanced stuff was coming in and Israel was suffering major damage. It got covered up in the press, but if you were on Telegram and you were on social media, you know that those missiles were starting to land. And I think it's now, in retrospect, and the things I've learned since the 12-day war, I'm fairly sure it was Israel that called the thing off and wanted an end because it wasn't going according to plan. Now, they've spent some time preparing. I think one of the reasons it hasn't happened yet is Israel wanted a bit more time. It didn't happen back in January because they needed a bit more time to prepare. I think everybody's as ready as they're going to get. All the assets are in place. But the same calculus applies, that they can go in, they can hit them hard for a week, they can go to limited targeting. But you're betting that Iran, and this is the real folly of this, you're betting that Iran will collapse into what? And you're betting that Iran has no ballistic missile defense capacity or offensive capacity. It's a really big gamble. But you're also betting that the regime will just collapse. If it does, there's nothing there to replace it. There's absolutely no plan on the books right now for what to do about installing a regime. There will be no ground troops this time. Iran is too big, and it's impossible. If you study the history of warfare, Alexander was the only one who really solved Iran from outside. And when a large conventional army from Iraq went into Iran, they treated it like lines on a map. They didn't treat it geographically accurately. And a lot of time and a lot of treasure and a lot of personnel were killed over nothing. When the war ended, Iraq was pretty much in the exact same place that they started. Iran's a very different beast. So there's, if the regime collapses, there's no plan for the vacuum that follows. And that's, tactically, you might be able to go in. You might be able to eliminate their defenses. You might be able to knock out the regime. But strategically, you don't have anything to replace it. Then there's the other side of the coin, that the regime doesn't fall. The IRGC does survive, and they maintain ballistic missile capabilities right now. And they start firing those missiles. They wait out. It looks like on paper for the first week to 2 weeks that the Americans and Israelis are just pummeling them. And then when all the expensive ordnance is expended, they start firing back. What happens when the United States and Israel lack the necessary munitions to knock those missiles out of the sky and they start doing significant damage to Israel? Or God forbid, they damage one of those carrier groupings and Americans start taking casualties. What if their missile defenses, when it comes to air, are actually still sitting there and work? And what if, under those circumstances, the United States and Israel want to end the conflict with some kind of negotiated settlement, having taught the Iranians a lesson, and the Iranians just say, nah, you know, we're doing damage now. I think we're just going to keep going. There's a lot of empty space where there should be a plan. There was a better plan for Iraq. It failed. But there was a better plan for Iraq. There was a better plan for Afghanistan. It failed too. This time round, there's not even a good plan for a post-regime world that could fail. There just doesn't seem to be a plan. There's a great big vacuum where something should be. And now people will say, trust the plan, trust Trump. I have faith in Trump. Never place your faith in men. Men are capable of making mistakes. Trump is one guy, maybe genuine in his desires. But he's one guy surrounded by sharks everywhere. And we saw what happened in the first term. We saw how he got bogged down. We saw how the election was stolen in 2020. He's one man. And if he's getting the wrong advice, if people are telling him you can just do a mini strike, you know, you can go in and you can do a limited thing, it won't be limited this time. Or you can go in all out and it'll be easy. It'll be a cakewalk. We'll take out Iran from the air. We won't have to land a single troop. You'll be hailed as a hero. I see nothing but risk here. Now, what else is going on out there? We'll bring the war to Russia if Moscow strikes Baltic states. Estonia says, tiny little Estonia. Russia is not looking to conquer Europe. Russia's been invaded 5 or 6 times by Europe. Russia's never invaded Europe. They liberated and kept. It's a bit of a different story. The Americans were doing that too. You know, it's interesting. We talk about Mossadegh. You want to get into a history lesson. Let's talk about the fact that of the 5,700 people that were convicted at Nuremberg, almost all of them were out of jail by the mid-50s and working in the West German government. Everybody knows about Operation Paperclip. What you don't know was how many Germans that weren't a part, and I shouldn't even say Germans, how many Nazis were a part that weren't a part of Operation Paperclip that ended up being saved by the Americans under Democrats and Republicans and installed in the West German government. That's a great big rabbit hole that you can go down if you're interested in history. But the fact is, Russia's not looking to invade Europe. Europe's a great big liability. They don't have anything that anybody needs. No one wants it. Russia, least of all, wants it. They would like European capital because Russia is this big basket of resources that Europe desperately needs, and that has been true since the 1930s and the 1940s. Europe is not a net producer of oil. They're not a net producer of gas. They're dependent on Russia. A business relationship would be the easiest way to check the Russians. We have to remember that it's NATO that has expanded right up to the border of Russia that started this problem. After promising the Russians they wouldn't do it, they went ahead and did it. And then they made a series of promises through their proxy in Ukraine and broke those promises. We wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for the West. That's the truth. And anybody who tells you otherwise is either ignorant or they're just flat out lying. Estonia's going to bring the war to Russia. Now, here's some major developments. And I wish I could put everything at the start of videos, but I can't. Major blow for Moscow. Ukraine targets Kyrenchnik missile site with fearsome new weapon. So what NATO is off to doing now is manufacturing components in European countries, so individual components, for these high-tech missiles. we're creating a huge problem. And then we're sending those components to Ukraine. They're assembling them in Ukraine, and they're calling them Ukrainian-made, but everybody knows the game. If I know the freaking game, everybody knows the game. And those highly technical, long-range missiles and the ability to build them will remain if the conflict is frozen in place. So what I'm trying to say is we're moving further and further away from a peace that Russia can accept. We've already been a long ways away from it, but we're moving further and further away. And they couldn't have hit this site if they did not have Western intelligence, likely U.S. intelligence. So how long can the Russians honestly tolerate the West? It's not just that Ukraine is a proxy army. It's that it is a forward command post for offensive operations inside of Russia. Zelensky claims West could use elections to oust him. So remember, for all the help the West is giving Ukraine and for all the people who are dying in the so-called defense of Ukraine, what you're actually defending is this man's corruption. Another thing he said is Ukraine corruption on par with rest of Europe. So it doesn't matter how corrupt Ukraine is because all of Europe is corrupt. Case closed. Nothing to see here. But this is the really important one. Russia says Britain and France plotting to give Ukraine nuclear weapons. Russian Foreign Intelligence Service says Germany wisely refused to participate in this dangerous adventure. Europe will destroy the world to keep this war going. That's why they're moving it further from peace. That's why they're assembling high-tech, long-range weapons in Ukraine, where all the components are made in Europe. It's nothing but escalation. They keep saying that Russia are the absolutists, that they won't come back to the table and make concessions. First off, Russia's in a position of strength, territorially, every single day. There was a couple days, I will grant this, there was a couple days the beginning of this month or during this month where Ukraine actually took more territory than Russia. First time I've seen that in months and months and months. Every day, it's that Russian grind. And the Russian grind after those couple days of counteroffensive, that Russian grind has renewed itself. The Russians are in a position of strength. You don't issue concessions from a position of strength. All this talk of the Russian economy falling apart, Russia's debt to GDP is 20% while they're operating a war. I mean, you can go on YouTube and you can watch Russian live streamers driving around St. Petersburg and Moscow and various other cities. You can see what the Russian people are up to. You can take in the nightlife via those live streams. You can see just how true what Europe is saying actually is. If you just get outside the mainstream media echo chamber, Russia's doing fine. They want the war over. The fatigue is real, but they're not willing to end the war or even turn against the government. Putin's still very popular. There's this rumor that keeps being circulated in Western media that he's on the verge of collapsing, that the Russian people want to pull him down. It's not true. And you can see it if you have the courage to look outside mainstream media sources. They can maintain for a long time this war effort. The issue is with Russia or with Britain and France looking at giving Ukraine nuclear weapons, that's an escalation they cannot sit with. Among the many escalations, I mean, there's a nuclear triad of Russia's deterrent, their nuclear deterrent against all other nuclear powers on Earth, not just Western powers. They took, with Western help, they took Ukrainian drone strikes on their strategic bomber fleet. Should have been off the table. They couldn't have done it without the West. But they went at the West, and Ukraine went ahead and did it. And Russia just ate that. At some point, they stop eating the damage. At some point, there's a red line and a Rubicon. And that's when things get really, really bad. And I worry the United States could have ended this when Trump came into office by simply withdrawing their support for Europe and Ukraine. Instead, we're in this protracted back and forth where the United States is still providing funding and still providing arms. Europe is paying for a lot more of it, but the U.S. is also still providing intelligence. And remember the meeting with Trump and Putin. They went to Anchorage. They had a meeting. They came to an understanding. Well, Lavrov has come out and said that it doesn't appear that understanding is holding anymore and that the Americans are not interested in pursuing it. And at some point, with the armada gathered around Iran, with that situation looking like Trump is going to be drawn into a war that he himself earlier in this video said that he wanted to avoid, the wars that he wanted to end, at some point you got to ask yourself, has something changed dangerously? It's not to say that Trump is going to redouble down and recommit to Ukraine, but there's been sanctions issued against Russia under Trump. There has been pressure. There has been counteractions that run counter to the narrative that he declared during the election campaign. And now it appears, as we all await the State of the Union tonight with bated breath, it appears they're, in my approximation, about to make the mistake of getting themselves committed to something that won't be a quick war. Iran will not be a quick war. Put it on the record, and I will be so happy to be wrong. I'll be happy to be wrong if those ships turn around and sail home. I'll be happy to be wrong if somehow it's miraculously quick and everything just works out roses. I think, and my concern is, we're a hair's breadth away from the kind of escalation that occurred at the beginning of World War I, where the alliance system, Germany and Austria, I know I'm going long here, but Germany and Austria are blamed for the First World War, but it wasn't Germany and Austria that kicked the thing off. It was the alliance system. Everything started moving faster than people could calculate. And there's a British writer, I can't remember his name, he's in one of these books that's on these shelves. And he was in Britain. It was business as usual. He boarded a plane. He flew into Africa back before there was telecoms everywhere. He was there for 3 weeks. He flew back, and all of a sudden, the world was engulfed in war, and he couldn't figure out how it happened. And that was the feeling of a lot of people at the time. And we know what happened. We've had, and I'll finish here, we've had this carefully choreographed back and forth between Iran and the United States going back for a long time, maybe a decade, maybe longer, depending on how you want to score it. When that choreography ends, when the tit-for-tat ends, when the understanding, unwritten understanding, loose understanding about the rules of warfare between Russia and the West, when that evaporates, then the chain of escalation gets out of the politician's hands, gets out of the planner's hands, gets out of it moves from tactics and strategy and choreography into unpredictability. And in a nuclear armed world, you can't have that. And by the way, one last point. We talk about how the Iranians could never be allowed to have a nuclear bomb. We had Witkoff come out and say, if they just commit to not pursuing nuclear weapons, everything would be fine. They've already done that. The Supreme Leader issued a fatwa against nuclear weapons. It doesn't get more clear than that. And do they enrich above what they need for civilian capacity? Absolutely they do. But why? For commercial use. To trade. Now you can argue that they shouldn't have any of it, or that they should have it, but this idea that they're pursuing nuclear weapons, they're clearly not. They have not been. And they lack the capacity. According to the Trump administration, that capacity has been destroyed anyway. And on top of the fact that Israel has a nuclear arsenal that is undeclared, illegal, they're not part of the non-proliferation treaties, and you can actually say that they're responsible for other nations on Earth getting nuclear weapons after they stole it from the Americans, they went and passed it on down the chain. Think India. But you know there is a Muslim nation on Earth right now. We talk about Iran and the Ayatollahs and how they can't have nuclear weapons, even though they're clearly not pursuing them. There's another nation on Earth that is Muslim that has nuclear weapons, and it's called Pakistan. Nobody wants to talk about it. I'm Frank Vaughn. If you like the work, please consider a donation via the website. I'll see you in the next one.